Take back the city for yourself tonight. I'll take back the city for me. Take back the city for yourself tonight. Whoa, whoa. God knows you put your life into its hands, and it's both cradled you and crushed.
Welcome to Third Paradigm, a weekly think tank on how to take back control of our cities, farmland, and water, of money, production, and trade, of media, education, and culture, of religion, and even of God. We focus on economics and community sovereignty and put religion in bed with politics. I'm your host, Teresa Caraggio, broadcasting from Free Radio Santa Cruz. Welcome to the fourth show of Third Paradigm. On our Thanksgiving show, we looked at food and farmer issues. We'll continue that theme with resource rights activist in Campeche, Mexico. Then we'll go shopping with a conscience and caroling with an agenda. We'll play an informative video clip from Oxfam's webinar on the global food crisis, and we'll focus on Ecuador's new constitutional protection for nature. Our feature rant today will be questioning the existence of money. Is it real? Is it alive? Is it friendly? But first, we'll read a poem by Stanley Kunitz called The Layers. I have walked through many lives, some of them my own, and I am not who I was. Though some principle of being abides, from which I struggle not to stray. When I look behind, as I am compelled to look before I can gather strength to proceed on my journey, I see the milestones dwindling towards the horizon, and the slow fires trailing from the abandoned campsites, over which scavenger angels wheel on heavy wings. Oh, I have made myself a tribe out of my true affections, and my tribe is scattered. How shall the heart be reconciled to its feast of losses? In a rising wind, the manic dust of my friends, those who fell along the way, bitterly stings my face. Yet I turn, exulting somewhat, with my will intact to go wherever I need to go, and every stone on the road precious to me. In my darkest night, when the moon was covered and I roamed through wreckage, a nimbus-clouded voice directed me, "Live in the layers, not on the litter." Though I lack the art to decipher it, no doubt the next chapter in my book of transformations is already written. I am not done with my changes. That was Stanley Kunitz from Passing Through. Families in Campeche, Mexico are also in their darkest night and roaming through wreckage. But their wreckage is privatization schemes and mega projects, like the construction of large hydroelectric dams and massive agrofuels plantations, which threaten their access to basic food and water resources. Now, simply for opposing the policies that jeopardize their livelihoods, activists face increasing repression and unjust prosecution, often without access to legal resources for their defense. An activist group recently targeted with civil resistance and non-payment to the Federal Electric Company. Based in Candelaria Municipality, Campeche, this organization is a member of Grassroots International's longtime ally, the Mexican Alliance for People's Self-Determination. Sarah and Joaquin, their leaders, are being prosecuted for opposing an increase in the price of electric service, which has skyrocketed alongside climbing oil prices and the construction of a hydroelectric dam, while the government subsidizes the cost of electric power for large energy-dependent agribusiness corporations. The people are left to foot the bill. At the same time, privatization of land and water reserves to produce agrofuels and hydropower diminishes the capacity of rural families to produce food and income. As one member of AMAP put it, first our land is invaded by foreign dams to produce energy, second comes an electric bill that few can afford to pay. Third, those who demonstrate against the high cost of electric services are violently repressed, 4th, organizers of demonstrations are arrested and charged with terrorism and formation of gangs. With no resources to pay for a lawyer or find a pro bono one, working families and indigenous people in Mesoamerica are facing trumped-up charges and harsh sentences for their ultimate decision to defend their resources rights. To sign on to a letter asking to end persecution of resource rights activists, please go to the website of Grassroots International. Resources and workers make the world go round. Protecting the latter are Sweat-Free Communities and the International Labor Rights Forum. They've teamed up once again to release the 2009 Shop with a Conscience Consumer Guide, filled with excellent products made under good working conditions. All retailers and wholesalers listed in the guide have undergone a rigorous application process. And when these guys say it, you know it's true. Liana Foxvogue of Sweat-Free Communities and Trina Toko of the ILRF were in town recently and came to talk to my high school group about making the Santa Cruz School District sweat-free. So these are some bulldog activists after my own heart. Also in the holiday spirit, in July, Global Exchange asked readers to write Christmas carols with a fair trade twist. Among the ones that they put in their Fairtrade Carol book is The Jingle Cells, which I wrote with my 14-year-old daughter, and I'm Dreaming of a Fairtrade Christmas, which I wrote with my 16-year-old. I saw Grant Wilson at the Human Rights Fair yesterday in Santa Cruz, who gets a group of alternative carolers together every year in front of Urban Outfitters. He's promised to record these to play on the show. Also at the fair, the Raging Grannies put on some very funny lyrics to some classics. They sang Brother, Can You Spare a Billion about the bailout and one about getting the house ready for Obama. My daughters and I are continuing that tradition because you're never too young to be a Raging Granny. Next week, we'll play an original song by a high school student called No Torture, which won the Amnesty contest at the fair, and a song my 10-year-old daughter and I wrote about child slavery on cocoa plantations. It's actually pretty uplifting, really. We'll also present more information about how Felton won the fight to buy back their water, and we'll hear the trailer to the movie thriller Flow about the privatization of water. Meanwhile, while we're breaking down Walmart's doors to get a 4 a.m. jump on Christmas shopping, and starvation has driven other populations to food riots and overthrowing governments, Oxfam has an ongoing series on the global food crisis called On the Ground. In the latest segment, Galeen Kripty presents a chart showing that food prices have risen 83% in the last 3 years. Locally grown produce and meat are relatively unaffected, but staples, which are shipped and controlled by international commodities traders, have doubled or more in price. To make matters worse, a color-coded map shows that the developed countries spend less than 25% of their income on food, but other countries spend over 50%. For the latter group, staples are the vast majority of their food source, but are less than 10% of ours. So when the cost of staples doubles, the jump in prices is minor for us, but is causing other families to pull children out of school, to forego medicine, to eat lower quality food, or to eat what isn't considered food at all. In this portion of the video, Galeen talks about the effects on Bangladesh, Afghanistan, and Haiti.
In other important aspects, what we call human capital, they sometimes have to pull children out of school or spend less on healthcare because they have to spend that money on food. And I already talked about the food riots happening, but we're seeing a level of unrest and dislocation that's very troubling. I wanted to just present a few examples of where this is happening around the world. And Bangladesh is an important example. Rice is the main commodity, and over the last 18 months, rice prices have risen dramatically, 60% in about 9 months. And as a result, poverty levels, Bangladesh is already a very poor country, but poverty levels have increased from 40% to about 48%. And that level of poverty is a really bleak measure. It's about $1.25 a day for each individual. This is very sad figures. And at the same time as people generally are getting poorer, we're seeing social inequality increase because some farmers are benefiting, but mostly very rich and big farmers are benefiting, whereas consumers of food and small farmers are not benefiting, and as a result, where social inequality is growing in Bangladesh. Another sort of extreme example is Afghanistan. We have some programs in Afghanistan looking at agriculture and food security, and Afghanistan was very hard hit by the food prices. The price of bread has gone up by over 90% since 2007, and because of the war in Afghanistan, food production is very low right now, and they have to import almost all their wheat for bread, mostly from Pakistan. In the middle of this crisis, Pakistan put an export ban on wheat, and so suddenly Afghanistan was without sources of wheat. Prices shot up, and more people have become food insecure. The World Food Program had to radically increase the amount of food it was delivering to Afghanistan because there just wasn't food in markets. And Oxfam did an assessment. We think about 5 million people are at extreme risk of food insecurity right now. And we're raising concerns about it because winter is coming now, and delivering food to more remote regions is impossible in the winter. And we've been very concerned about getting food in place in time for the winter. We think it's about the worst situation in 20 years in Afghanistan. Another sad story is the case of Haiti. Haiti has, if you've read the newspapers in the last couple of years, a lot of trouble. But one of their problems is the decline in agriculture in Haiti. And so they're not producing nearly as much food as they used to be. They're, again, importing a lot of food. And these price increases have made it very hard for Haiti to afford to do the imports that they were doing. There's a tradition of making mud cakes in Haiti. They were mostly used for folk treatments for pregnant women. There was a folk treatment to help pregnant women. They were thought to be good for the health of the mother and baby. But now it's these mud cakes, which are made of salt and clay and vegetable shortening, have become a staple for poor people. Many more people are eating them, and mud cake makers are making a lot more of them. Because it's one of the only affordable things on markets right now. Haiti's been very unstable for various reasons, but the food prices created a real cataclysm, and there were very big riots that happened, and the prime minister was overthrown because of the food riots earlier this year. In general, the people that are most victim to decisions that reduce food are women and children. That's probably because of household dynamics, where they have the least control over budget spending. And I just wanted to give you an example of some of the field reports we're seeing in southern Senegal. We're seeing one of the things that I was interested in, to see the increased banditry. People are stealing more because of the high food prices. There have been very hungry, very large numbers of hungry people in the world even before the food prices went up. But the increases are very dramatic in the gross numbers. The best estimates are that the number of hungry people around the world has grown by 75 to 130 million people just in the last year. And these are very big numbers, and they don't mean anything as numbers, but it's important to remember that these are people. Each number is an individual who is not getting enough to eat.
Galene Kripty from the Oxfam webinar on the ground. But in Ecuador, new life is rising out of the ashes of the neoliberal model. For the first time, a constitution has been approved which gives rights to nature, as if it's something real, like a corporation. These are the first five articles that recognize the rights of nature in Ecuador. Article 1. Nature, or Pachamama, where life is reproduced and exists, has the right to exist, persist, maintain and regenerate its vital cycles, structure, functions, and its processes in evolution. Every person, people, community, or nationality will be able to demand the recognitions of rights for nature before the public organisms. Article 2. Nature has the right to an integral restoration. In the cases of severe or permanent environmental impact, including the ones caused by the exploitation of non-renewable natural resources, the state will establish the most efficient mechanisms for the restoration and will adopt the adequate measures to eliminate or mitigate the harmful environmental consequences. Article 3. The state will motivate natural and juridical persons, as well as collectives, to protect nature. It will promote respect towards all the elements that form an ecosystem. Article 4. The state will apply precaution and restriction measures in all the activities that can lead to the extinction of species, the destruction of the ecosystems, or the permanent alteration of the natural cycles, the introduction of organisms and organic and inorganic material that can alter in a definitive way the natural genetic patrimony is prohibited. And Article 5, the persons, people, communities, and nationalities will have the right to benefit from the environment and form natural wealth that will allow well-being. The environmental services cannot be appropriated. Its production, provision, use, and exploitation will be regulated by the state. This information came to me through the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, which is an amazing group that's at the forefront of community sovereignty. We'll be hearing much more about them in episodes to come. In another exciting move in Ecuador, they've done an extensive audit of their debt, what they consider legitimate and what they might not consider paying. So stay tuned for further updates on that. You're listening to Third Paradigm. We'll go now to break and return with our feature analysis, Doubting the Existence of Money. As a fitting lead-in to this topic, this is Arcade Fire with a song called Intervention.
You're still a soldier in your mind, still nothing's on the line. You say it's money that we need, as if we're only mouths to feed. I know no matter what you say, there's some debts you'll never pay. Working for the church while your family dies. You take what they give you and you keep it inside. Every spark of friendship and love will die without a home. Hear the soldier groan, go at it alone. Take me out of here. Don't wanna fight, don't wanna die. Just wanna hear you cry. Who's gonna throw the very first stone? While my family dies, your little baby sister's gonna lose her mind. Every spark of friendship and love will die without a home. Hear the soldier groan, we'll go at it alone.
That was Intervention by Arcade Fire. On our Sunday editorials, we've been discussing God as a concept that is open to debate. Whether or not we believe that God exists, we first have to define what concept of God we believe or don't believe in. Money, however, is also a concept. Whether it's backed by gold or oil or the vaporware of an electronic blip, none of these things have value except what we agree to give it. Also like God, it's a concept that's talked about, and we can live our whole lives by its rules, but we never define it. It's assumed that everyone knows what we mean by money or God. We may fiercely reject both and their power over us, but we don't get to the heart of it by challenging their authority, by which I mean its authorship. Authority comes from the word author. Who is the author of the concept of money? Who is the author of the concept of God? Even more than God, money is given the status of personhood and characterized as a living thing. Money doesn't grow on trees, we say, but underlying that is the assumption that it does and should grow under the tender loving care of banks and stockbrokers. Put your money to work for you, solicitations read, as if money had hands. But wealth, true wealth, only comes about through the interaction of two things, labor and resources. Money provides neither. The worst effect of the myth of money isn't on us. Money is seen as giving a micro fraction of the world's population, about 0.001%, the right to own 75% of the land and its resources. Trade agreements give corporations the right to sue governments if they enact labor or environmental laws that threaten their future earnings. Money's rights trump individual human rights and even trump the rights of nature and humanity. So if we agree that money is a concept, a symbol, what is it a symbol of? If something represents another thing, you should be able to take out the representation and show the real process or relationship that it stands for. Part of our vocabulary, our common ideology, is that money is a unit of trade. When I explain this to students, what I have them do is look at the tags in the back of each other's shirts and figure out where they were made. Then I ask them, what does your parents' labor do for the people who live in this country? I've yet to find anyone whose parents make a living by providing a good or service in return to the world's producers. So how is it possible that our whole society produces almost nothing for our own needs and nothing that goes in trade to those who do produce what we need to live or what we want? If you take the concept of money out, there is no trade. Free trade agreements aren't free, aren't trade, and aren't agreements. Unless you count the products made by people that we consider illegal, none of our labor and resources go out of this country to the people making our products and growing our food. Money is a one-way conveyor belt to bring the products of other people's labor and resources to the supposed owners of the land, of the factories, of the equipment, and of the shipping channels, even though each of these is built and operated by those who aren't included. So what is money really? I believe that it's a fictional increment of advantage. Let me say that again. An incremental and fictitious measure of one person's advantage over another. It's as if we took nothing and sliced it up into infinitesimal pieces that we could then count, manipulate, calculate, and use. The authors of this fiction are the owner class, the mythical microfraction of the world's population. They parcel out little bits of their advantage to us. We're the collaborator class, who are essential for the system to work. If we didn't go along with it, no military would back up their claims. Money, in the form of college education, buys our willingness to go to war. The wars keep the products flowing that the money buys. The cheap overseas products destroy our ability to make a living by making and growing things at home. This forces youth into college under the promise that they can join the ruling class that makes the money that gets the products. It's a vicious circle, except for the owner class, for whom it works very well. If you can measure something, does it make it real? Do the emperor's clothes exist if you have their exact specifications? What money is in our society is empire chips, tokens of the empire's appreciation. For someone who serves in a minor capacity, say a janitor in a school, they throw them a few empire chips. If someone, however, figures out a tax loophole to hide lots of empire chips in, they deserve a bigger portion. These are like gambling chips in the big casino that we call the business world. When we continue with this theme, we'll ask, does giving a country money give them an advantage? And we'll look in terms of that at the Peru Free Trade Agreement. And pro-development models of how to help other countries and whether they promote dependency. We'll look at money and food production as opposite means of achieving security, and at one micro-loan agency called TechnoServe, which I think is a good example of this. We'll also look at whether advantage serves us through money and the oxymoron that I think financial independence is. We'll look at master-slave theory and notice that the slave is actually not dependent on the master, which may be coming to roost when we have to go cold turkey without the turkey in the looming food crisis in the U.S. But finally, we'll see how we could gradually back down from our faith in money so that when we're pushed off this precipice that our advantage has built, we won't have as far to fall. This has been Teresa Caraggio as your host of Third Paradigm, broadcasting from Free Radio Santa Cruz. Thank you to Skidmark Bob for production, editing, and music. We'll leave you with Devochka, How It Ends, which was featured in the wonderful film Little Miss Sunshine. Thank you for listening.
Hold your grandmother's Bible to your breast. Gonna put it to the test. You wanted it to be blessed. And in your heart, you know it to be true. You know what you gotta do. They all depend on you and you. A million.